be here. Whenever I was in a preaching class back in seminary, one of the professors said, do not ever underestimate the idea that they showed up. And start every session that you do, whether preaching or teaching, with gratitude. And so thank you. There are a number of things you could be doing with this time, including I'm the advocate for naps. So you could have been napping at this point, but thank you for taking this time to be here. I finished my PhD at Bright Divinity School, which is affiliated with Texas Christian University, TCU, go Frogs, in Fort Worth last year. And our family moved into Texas so that I could do this PhD because I was very interested in the way that the Roman Empire was context for the New Testament. I also brought an interest in gender to the table, having done some feminist work in some previous graduate programs. And it wasn't until I put those pieces together that I realized, oh, so then I really need to be thinking about masculinity, especially when you're talking about biblical text. So all of this came to fruition throughout creative conversation in my PhD program. So I put these pieces together, and what that means, which is kind of a scary thing in academia, is that I'm not really an expert in any of these things. Masculinity, Roman Empire, the closest is the Bible. But then, you know, to say you're an expert in the Bible is foolish at best. But because I put these pieces together in a new way, then the conversation shifts and new questions bubble up. And one of the things I'm learning when I do these kinds of presentations is that everybody in the room, especially at Holden, brings their own expertise, their own life experiences, particularly if I identify as a man, right, that I do not have. And so I am here to present information to you, but also foster conversation and to hopefully bring you some tools so that you can start to do some of this analysis in your own context and maybe have some conversations you haven't had before, whether that's in your personal life or in a community. I want to say to today, we're going to talk more about empire and Rome and men in that era than Bible. Because I feel like that's the part where we need to fill in a few gaps, maybe, for some of you. Do we have any classicists in the room, like people who are classics scholars? That's really too bad, because at some point it would be nice if there's a question I can't answer immediately, which, of course, I can look up, that we could go to. But it also means that that's good, because some of this stuff won't be already known. So if it takes a little bit of patience because you know some of this stuff, thank you in advance for your patience. But I feel like it's good to get everybody on the same track before we head out. Okay. So one of the first questions that people ask sometimes is why do we even talk about empire in context for the New Testament? Because I grew up in an era where it was all about Jewish context, and that's perfectly wonderful and fine. But as people have searched for new things to study and also learned more about the ancient world, I've realized that if we're not talking about empire also, then we're missing a whole section of this. Now, when I was a kid, the idea of the Roman Empire showed up about the time Jesus died and about the time Jesus was born. We had the text where, in those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus, or maybe in your Christmas program you said Caesar. That was the very first line I ever said in church as a child in the Christmas program. I couldn't pronounce Caesar and Syria, therefore, I was up front. Yes, in those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus. And so someone would undoubtedly explain who Augustus was as the emperor, but that's about as far as we would get. And then when, at the very bottom, in John 18, they took Jesus from Caiaphas to Pilate's headquarters. All of a sudden, now we would need to have some sort of explanation of who these people are. Why does Pilate exist, and what's he doing there? But in between, there wasn't a lot of reference. And so just as a reminder, in addition to the beginning and the end, there are actually many texts, some of them cloaked, so you don't see them right away, that do have to do with empire. Matthew 8, when Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, appealing to him. This isn't seen as out of the ordinary to have a centurion. That's a centurion who's a head of 100 people, right? That it's not seen as out of the ordinary for this to happen. We forget that during the time that Jesus was alive, the area he was in was occupied. So military Roman presence was everywhere. So a lot of the things that the stories that are told are filtered through that, and we forget what it would be like to live in that kind of world, where the ultimate, like, imperial power wasn't even close to you, but boy, did they make their presence known in military occupation. Then Mark 12, they sent to Jesus some Pharisees and some Herodians to trap him. Knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, whose head is this and whose title? They answered, the emperor's. This is that classic story where they give him the coin, and they ask him, who's on the coin? And he says, this is the emperor. And they're trying to trap him because they want to see if how he will sort out his loyalties. Because in an occupied land, you have to do enough lip service not to get in trouble, but you also have convictions. So when you talk about coins, the empire was everywhere. It was in their pocket. You carried it with you. And Rome knew this, and so they put their power, their theology, their masculinity on coins. So that as you walked around, you carried it along with you. So rather than seeing, my dissertation director, Dr. Warren Carter, hates it when we use the word background. He said, you will never use the word background. You will use the word context. Because there's no such thing as background when it comes to Rome. They won't settle for that. They are in the front. They are the context for everything that happens. So that's just a little bit of thought about why we wouldn't talk about Rome. And then here's a little geography, because I never understood this whole thing with Pilate and Herod, Antipas, and who's the other Herod, and how do all these people relate to each other? So Herod the Great was the dad, and Herod the Great was in charge of the area where Jesus was born and lived and died. And then Herod the Great, as it tells us in Matthew three times, he dies. They make a big deal about the fact that Herod the Great dies. And at that point, then, they have to divide up what's left. And his will had to be ratified by Augustus, because this is a Roman province. So the explanation that's given and the way that things happen is the pink area at the top was this Galilee. That was given to the son named Herod Antipas. We'll talk about him later. He's the Herod that has the John the Baptist and the cutting off of the head business. The area that's the light green, down there you'll see Samaria, and then you come down to Judea. That was given to the son named Archelaus. You've not heard of him. He was bad at his job. He was very bad at his job. So he was deposed. And then Augustus had a problem because there wasn't like another kid to put in the mix. They were already occupied. Another son was had another area. And the area in gray, which is not labeled, is the area given to the daughter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I picked this map on purpose for that reason. So he has nobody to rule this area. It's notoriously difficult because Jews have complicated relationships with the empire. Because they will offer sacrifices for, but not to, the Roman gods. This is a volatile kind of place. So instead of putting somebody in permanently, you get this rotating system of governors that are all subject to the empire. That's how you end up with Pilate, who's in charge here. Not from here, don't know anything about it. Sent here, probably not all that happy about it, because it's a huge test, and it's not a very important place in the empire itself. Okay, I'm gonna stop for a moment, and I'm gonna say, of everything that I just said, raise your hand if you knew all of that before you walked in the room. Okay, this is good news. Look around. Yeah, nobody else knows all of this. So if you're feeling a little overwhelmed, sorry, I'll slow down. But it's also good to just recognize that this is all biblical context, which most of us have never been exposed to. It took me going to a PhD program to spend a lot of time thinking about all of this stuff. Yeah.
You have two pink areas that are separated. You have two gray areas that are separated. Mm-hmm. The daughter, is she in charge of both of those gray areas that are separated? And so I'm assuming then that both of those areas are kind of very little consequence. All the important stuff they can leave in the middle for the son.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And they're cities. The parts that she has are two sort of civilized areas and then the area around them. Okay. So they were divided up based on the major metro areas. So if it were Texas, you would say, you get DFW, you get Houston, you get San Antonio and Austin, right? And you get the bottom, like the Gulf Coast. So it's based around that kind of theory.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So where we intersect with this, of course, is in Matthew 3. When Herod died, again, we hear about Herod's death all the time, this is Herod the Great. An angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. So first he comes to the light green area, right to Judea, and then understanding how brutal Archelaus was one of the reasons why he didn't last very long, they end up going to the pink area, which is the area of Herod Antipas, not all that much safer, but home. Yeah, so a place where you have network and connections. All right, so the Roman world that's around when Jesus is there is not background, it is context. It is every day, it is in your pocket. Okay, so we're going to talk about very briefly, just two groups of emperors, because there's a ton of them. And these are the ones that have the most to do with the time that Jesus was alive, and then the writing of the books of the New Testament. So over here on the left, we have the Julio-Claudians. They get their name from Julius Caesar, who was taking everything from the Republic into the Empire. The guy on the left here is Augustus. He's the one after which everybody tries to copy. Because when you make the mold, break the mold, and everybody tries to be like you after that. So he's the one that's emperor when Jesus is born. Then the next one is Tiberius, and he's the one that's emperor when Jesus dies. We don't hear about him so much, but he would have been the one in charge of having Pilate in place. Then we have Gaius Caligula in the middle. Then the guy with the wreath, that's Claudius. So about the time that Rome starts to expand into Britain, to go up north, Claudius is the expander. He's the one that makes the empire big. And then Nero, famous Nero, who's the one who fiddles while Rome burns. He was also quite irresponsible. And there was a great fire in Rome. And after that, he conveniently built his grand palace right on top of where all those people used to live and where they died. So at the end of Nero's reign, he dies, very bad. And then there's a bunch of civil war, a bunch of unease. Several men claim to be emperor. They get their 5 minutes of 15 minutes of imperial fame. Enough time to make coins, because they want to have coins with their names on them. But Galba, Ulto, and Vitellius, you've never heard of. Then, after that horrible year of war, civil war, and trying to figure out who's going to be next, up rises the guy on the left in the second group of the Flavians. His name is Vespasian. Vespasian comes to notoriety and fame as a general with his son Titus, who's in the middle, before the sack of Jerusalem. So around the year 70, right? That's when Jerusalem falls and the Flavians come to power. So Vespasian's on the left, Titus is in the middle, Domitian's on the right. The two guys on the right are brothers. They're his sons. So the Flavians are the emperors at the time the New Testament, like the Gospels, are written. So when you hear about these things in the New Testament stories, they're talking about the Flavian times. They would harken back maybe to Nero, but the current regime are the Flavians. I want to point out, because it'll be important later, you'll notice that the hair is not the same. And also the way that they draw themselves is not the same. The Julio-Claudians, they have these real tight curls up at the front. There are scholars who do work on how the curls fall on people's heads in statues. Because they meant it. They were very specific in how they pictured themselves. And these men didn't look like this. We'll talk about more about this later. You know, we don't know what they look like, but they certainly didn't stay looking like this throughout life. But it was really important for them to present a certain persona. The men on the right, especially Vespasian, he looks like an everyman. He doesn't have the look of an elite. The hair is quite different. The Flavians were known as trying to connect back with the people because Nero had been so wacky and so out of bounds. So masculinity is not the kind of thing where you create an image and then after that it's always the same. It changes. But there are certain elements of it that remain the same as people did their reinterpretations. Okay, so these are the men who are actually in charge of the world when Jesus is alive, when he dies, and then when the Bible is written. You can see, in a lot of ways, it has to do with the noses, too. Like, the noses have to look a certain way in order to belong. The Julio-Claudian noses are similar, and the Flavian noses are similar. If you travel a lot, you'll see that in a lot of places, it's the ancient statues, the noses are the things that are broken. Partially because they're easy to break off, but partially because it removes people's dignity really fast. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit for a couple minutes about Augustus. Again, Caesar Augustus is the one who basically invents, he makes being an emperor a thing. It was started with Julius Caesar, his adopted father. But after that, after Augustus, now there's an empire, and that means there's an emperor. And he has to sell this idea of being an emperor after them having so much pride in having a republic before. So everything that Augustus does is intentional, and it's propaganda, and it's meant to build up his own persona so that when you see him, you understand how important he is. On the right, that's the Primaporta statue, and the thing that he's wearing around him, all around those little statues of things that are carved into there, those are conquered nations. that after they would come back, they would build statues or put up arches, and they would have images of the people that they conquered. And interestingly, it depends on the person and the era. If you conquer somebody, do you want them to look really intimidating, or do you want them to look really weak?
Weak.
It depends. Because if you want to say that it took a lot for you to win, then you want them to look pretty masculine, big deal.
Yeah.
If you want to build up your own masculinity and say no contest, then the other people look weak. So we'll look at a few statues in a minute that show this in specifics. But this is important because in order to build up your own masculinity, there are different ways of doing that. And so for Augustus, part of it was showing the people that they'd beaten, whether or not they were uber masculine or whether or not they were seen as weak. So that's the military side. On the bottom, you can see him, he's got the thing over his head. Prior to Augustus, there was a thing called the Pontifex Maximus in Rome, and that was like a head priest who dealt with the Vestal Virgins. And that's a whole other fun, absolutely amazing thing to think about in Rome. After Augustus, there's no turnover. It's always the emperor. He is the head of religion. So he is the head of the military, and he's the head of religion. So he wears his head scarf. He sacrifices to the gods. He is very involved in religion and the way that people understand their religion. And then he starts to push the boundary of being sort of associated with the divine, that he himself has divine roots, and it's not an accident that he is where he is. And the gods have picked him to do his job. So it's not just military, it's also religious. Okay. The top one I just put in so you can see the fringe. I hope they do a lot of that study with the fringe. All right. Underneath all of this is the shadow of Alexander the Great, who comes before Rome. And Alexander the Great is the reason why the New Testament is written in Greek. Alexander the Great is also a great military leader. He's an empire builder. He was an urban center guy. So you can see the roots of Rome in all of this. That's why we call it the Greco-Roman world or Hellenistic world, because of Alexander's influence. And sometimes I sort of doubted the idea that, I mean, he'd lived like 300 years before. How important could he be? But these are all pictures, places that I've been, things I've taken. So the one on the top left there, it's from Pompeii. It's a huge mosaic that was on the wall of some rich person's house. Mm-hmm. And that's Alexander in battle. So that's southern Italy. The one on the bottom is hard to see, but it's similar. It's Alexander on a horse, and he's riding into battle. That is in Sepphoris, which is an archaeological site near Nazareth, right near where Jesus was raised, Alexander the Great. Then on the top, you can see Alex with his sword on the... This is somebody else's sarcophagus, but they just put Alexander on there because they wanted to be affiliated with him. And that's in Istanbul, in Turkey. And then the lower right, that's from Rome. That's from the Capitoline Museum, so a picture of Alexander. What's important about Alexander, we'll pick up later, is that he's very much a military genius and bold and rides into battle, and he also has very fluid sexuality. And that becomes part of the thing, the slippery thing that moves itself into masculinity then in Rome. So underneath Augustus is always Alexander. So this is the best example I can think of to show you what it is Augustus was trying to do, who he was. This is called the Ara Pacis. It's an altar that Augustus had made after some of his military victories. It's inside a museum now in Rome. It had sunk into the silt and was dug back out and put into this museum so that people could come and see it. But when it was built, it was on the Campus Martius, and it had an Egyptian obelisk stolen, right? Taken from one of the provinces. Huge obelisk that was used as a solarium. You could tell time and the date by. And when the sun hit the solarium on Augustus's birthday, it shone directly into the center of the altar. This is not an accident. Yes, and it's not an accident that it's an obelisk. Right? It's phallic. Yeah. So the altar itself is a working altar. You can see the drains on the sides where the blood would have run out after they sacrificed animals. So it's an altar to peace, which of course is predicated on war, because these were done after Augustus' military victories. And it's all around it, carved into it, are symbols of this kind of productivity and control over the world. And then, of course, religion. So Augustus himself, he's almost on the right side there. He's half cut off. He's in the middle. It's hard to see, but they did finally identify which one he is. He leads a procession of people behind him. This one's easier to see, so I left it. This is Agrippa here. And you can see that Agrippa also has this toga on with the head covering. They're going to sacrifice at the altar. They're going to go and offer animals up to the gods in gratitude or in supplication. And then you can see there's a child. This was very much about family values, about traditional family values that are mixed up in religion. So not only then is Augustus the head of the military, he's the head of religion, he's the head of the home, the traditional, as they would understand, traditional family home. So the parade of people going around the top of this is there's women, and there's men, there's kids of all ages, but Augustus leads the whole thing. He's in charge of the procession. Okay? It's also on the very top of the altar. So this isn't, I mean, he's as high as you can possibly get. So there's a differential between the people who are down below and then the people who are up on the top. Okay? I'll pause here for a minute. We're pretty deep into the Roman stuff, and you're wondering, what does it have to do with the Bible? Yeah. So we'll get there eventually. Any questions or thoughts?
What is an obelisk?
Yeah, so that's one of those things that's got the four sides, and it's got a pedestal, and it sits up, and it looks... I may have a picture of one coming up. There you go, Washington Monument. Yeah, there you go. It's an obelisk. And when... before he was Augustus, his name was Octavian. And Octavian and Mark Antony were the ones that avenged Julius Caesar's death by fighting off Brutus and Cassius. Then Mark Antony ran off with Cleopatra. So then Octavian's fighting Cleopatra and Mark Antony. So that's how Egypt kind of gets involved in all of this. So after that, then when they would go to Egypt, they would bring home these enormous obelisks and stand them up all over Rome to say, this is, we are in charge of these people, this mighty, once mighty empire. Yeah, we take these home for us.
The statue with the baby hanging on the coattails that was earlier, what was that symbolizing?
Which one?
It was a couple of slides earlier, the baby's kind of hanging by the coattails.
Yeah, that's the same thing, that's the Areopagus. So it's the same, that's Agrippa, so that's the same kid. And they're going to...
So it's his child?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so there was an attachment here between fathers and children. It was largely based on legacy and masculinity and being able to propagate the species, and these are my heirs. But there was a relationship there, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, anything else about our patches? What's interesting to me from a contemporary perspective is, like I said, they had to dig the Areopagus out, and then they had to put it on display in Rome, and they built a thing around it, and the person who was really interested in that was Mussolini. Mm. Why is Mussolini interested in that? He's doing the same thing Augustus did, right? Mm-hmm. He's building on the legacy. When you go to Rome, it's just layer after layer of power, power, power. That title Pontifex Maximus that Augustus took for his own, the Pope's used. Yeah, Pontifex Maximus. So the layers of power that go on top of one another, you take the previous generation, then you add to it, and then you kind of tweak it so it fits your context. All right, so this is the, I just wanted to show you, sometimes we forget that these big marble things were actually painted. And so the one on the left, this is the goddess Pax, so this is the peace that comes. And the whole idea here is control over creation. That by winning these military victories, Augustus has brought peace and abundance and plenty to the empire. I have brought peace to my new empire, and I think of it at the end of the third Star Wars movie. Yeah. And so the one on the left, she's riding a goose, so that's the earth, and on the right is a sea monster. So lord over land and sea, Augustus claims dominion over the whole world. On the right are the words carved into the wall outside this thing in the museum. And it's called the Res Gestae. I don't know if you've heard of the Res Gestae. Augustus basically wrote his own obituary, which was his own CV, and had it sent all throughout the empire before he died. So no one would ever be confused about what he had done, who he had subjugated, how many nations he had conquered, and how he had then brought peace to them. So this is written in carved in stone on the outside of the Areopagus. So contemporary people have just continued the mystique of Augustus by doing this, by adding all of this to the edge. So there are copies of the Res Gestae all over the world, but the one that we found that was the most intact is in the East, in the Greek-speaking East. So it made it all the way out there. and it mattered to people who were there. Okay, but one more piece of this before we move on to actual talking about masculinity and how it relates. This is the Arch of Titus, which is in the Roman Forum. The Arch of Titus was put up in 82, so we're talking a number of decades later, right? Augustus is right around the turn of the century when Jesus is born, and then this happens in 82, so long after Jesus dies. This is put up by Domitian to honor his brother Titus. Remember those Flavians? And it features, on the underside of the arch, it features the Sack of Jerusalem. So it's underneath here. It's on this side. You can see right here, this is the menorah. And all of the people who are walking. And they are all carrying things that people brought back from Jerusalem. So how the Romans understood Jews was, oh yeah, those are people we beat. And we brought all their stuff back. And we took their religious symbols with us. And we brought all of the treasury from the temple. And we gained a lot of money. And we gained some slaves to help us build the Colosseum. So Titus, the Arch of Titus, is here to commemorate this victory. So sometimes we think, we get this idea that we're talking about the New Testament, we're talking about Judaism and Christianity, that we're talking about things that mattered. Of course we do. But not to Rome, or not the same way. Right? They're symbols of what we have, the Romans have done, what they've been able to be, to in order to conquer. Okay, done with those kind of pictures. So we're going to talk a little bit about masculinity. Roman masculinity has some similarities to ours, and it's also kind of different. So as we're talking about this, I want you to be trying to make those connections. Where do you see things that resonate with your experience of the expectations of masculinity, and where are there differences, where it's not a perfect fit? So that's what I kind of want you to be thinking about as we talk about these things. All of these statues, by the way, are just unnamed Romans, anonymous Roman men in museums where I've been. I have a habit of taking their pictures so that I can look at them later and think about them. One of the most important concepts to understand when talking about ancient masculinity is that gender is an expression or a performance. So just because you have particular body parts does not a man make. That in order to become a man or to be considered a man by those who are around you, you have to behave in a certain way. You may need to take on certain characteristics. You may need to have certain emotions and not have other emotions. And you may have to be able to dominate other men in order to slide up the scale. It's a very unstable kind of concept. Because in any particular room, you kind of have to figure out who's the real man in this room. Talking about hegemonic masculinity, ideal masculinity, means that there's one real man. And there's one real man in the house, there's one real man in the polis, there's one real man in the temple, there's one real man in government. So there's different scales to this. But the idea that there's a sliding scale and there's competition among men in order to secure status means that there's kind of this constant negotiation going on of who has the credentials, who has the one to say, well, I pull rank in this room, I'm the one who's the real man in this room. If you can go up the scale, that also means you can come down the scale. You can be emasculated. Those can happen in a number of ways. Someone can beat you in a public debate. Then you are emasculated in the Roman Empire. You can be so, if certain sexual behavior is outed, then you can slide down the scale. So you might, as I'm saying these things, you might sense some similarities, but also some differences to the way that we understand. But the point I want to make first and foremost is that this is a performative task. Use Judith Butler's performativity word. That there's no guarantee of any kind of manhood or masculinity just because you are a biological male. And that's not really a concept that they deal with. Masculinity, being a man, is something that you do, you accomplish, you perform, you prove. Okay? That's important. All right. And then the multiple playing fields for how this takes place. Economics, physical attributes, sexuality, religion, political or military power. There's a science that they called physiognomy, which is where physiognomists would evaluate other men's gait, like how they walked, how they used their voices, their hair, where their hair grew on their body and where it didn't, and they would then pronounce them to be real men or not. They would be able to tell just by looking at you whether or not you were a real man. Well, that's terrifying, isn't it? Yeah. So there's all, it's not just that you were yourself trying to prove, it's that other people were watching. Yeah, okay? So in all of these areas, we'll get to the some of the behaviors in a second, but the sexuality thing is important because this has nothing to do with the gender of a partner and everything to do with the thing that you do when you are engaged in sexual activity. If you are the person, I see you. If you are the person who can protect your body and penetrate or violate someone else's, you're the man. Doesn't have anything to do with the gender of that person. Mm-hmm. And if you are the person who is penetrated or violated, then you are not the man. And it has nothing to do with your gender or the other person's gender. Okay? Yeah.
So if there was always like one real man in government and there was always, so there's one standard, does that mean that the standard changed as the leader and the one real man changed?
Yes. Yes, it did, but at the same time, I think the ideals remain the same. Maybe the way that they embodied the ideals would be different. So if you look at the difference between those emperors that went by, you know, yes, there's differences among them, but every single one of them looks young, every single one of them looks strong, physically strong, every single one of them has military victories to his name, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So they might embody it, there would be variations on the theme, to use a musical terminology. All right, so I've talked about this and alluded to this. The whole system here, as you might guess, is sort of marked by instability. And that you never quite knew where you stood, mm-hmm. but it's masked as permanence. What do I mean by that? I mean that people say in the Roman world, masculinity is fragile. Therefore, we need to protect it. And we need to make sure that our men are real, real, real men, because otherwise they will be open and subject to critique, or they will be subject to being beaten in battle. So this constant talk about how fragile it is strengthens it. So it's an illusion that they put up. Okay? That might sound familiar. When I talk about hegemonic masculinity, it's a certain kind, right? That's a power over other people. It is dominance, physical dominance, economic dominance, all of that stuff. And because of that, it's only available to a certain group of people. This diagram that I put up is from a guy named Lenski. It's really, it's sort of standard in all this kind of empire literature stuff. And you'll see that at the bottom, it's got the small group, and then it's got the big group. There's no such thing as a middle class. Like, that's not what I'm suggesting. But there's like this bigger group near the bottom, and then it thins out as you get to the top. So everything I've talked about so far just has to do with like the tip of it, the people who qualify. The people who have time to think about this, the people who have the money, the people who have the power militarily. There's this broad swaths of humanity that are not involved in this conversation at all. Mm-hmm. They're not involved in the idea of hegemonic masculinity or ideal masculinity. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to notice that on that thing, there's a dot at the top. That's Augustus. He's not even in the chart. He's so far above, and that's what I mean by one, right? So the ideal masculinity piece, you know, this is the information we have. These are the things people wrote about. These are the people were interested in. So the whole thing at the bottom is, it's a well, we don't know, question mark. Fascinating thing is, Teresa Morgan, who's a classicist, suggested that one of the ways we can find out about what the rest of the men were like, the New Testament. It's one of the only texts from the ancient world that we have that's actually about ordinary people. That we cared about people who didn't have money, who didn't have military might, right? Who were able to manifest that. Okay. So the alternatives to this hegemonic thing, this is the big question. What is it like to be a man who doesn't have military prowess, a ton of money, and the head or like a divine association? What's that man like? What's his life like? How does he use power? How does he negotiate with other people? And part of the argument that's made about masculinity, especially hegemonic masculinity, is it's a system of oppression for everybody. So all of the men who are not involved in this ideal hegemonic thing, they're being damaged by this system because it reduces agency, right? It says you're not a real man. There's all kinds of oppression that takes place in that big group of men. So any kind of dominant, kind of hegemonic, imperial, ideal masculinity is really only good for one guy. Everybody else suffers. Suffers from lack of identity, suffers from lack of agency and power. So hegemonic masculinity doesn't do anybody any favors except the one guy who wins until he is killed and the next guy jumps into place. Mm-hmm. That being said, so all that's true, that thing about, you know, men being suffering at the hands of hegemonic masculinity, all of that is true. At the same time, in systems that are based on this kind of masculinity, there is something called the patriarchal dividend. And I love this term. What that means is there is a certain value or benefit of the doubt that men receive that people of other genders or gender expressions do not receive. So there is an assumption that if you are male, you are more competent than a female of the same class.
So with regards to the hegemonic masculinity, if you apply the hegemonic economic theory, let me rephrase that. Is there a parallel between hegemonic masculinity theory to hegemonic economic theory, where hegemonic economic theory, the hegemon pulls all others along with it, and although it might not be sufficiently wonderful to be one of the lesser superpowers, they all rise with it. Is there a parallel within the masculinity theory that would demonstrate that or not?
Yeah, I'm assuming that hegemonic economic theory is a contemporary theory. It's like a current theory.
Yeah, that actually goes back. Yeah, it goes back to the Roman times.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar. Okay. So that's helpful.
Hegemon pulls all others. They ride on the coattails, in essence, of the hegemon, even with the Roman Empire. Stability, peace, economic with the with farming, agriculture, social systems that rises their status.
Yeah, so absolutely. So if you find yourself in the company of a real man, as long as you're willing to not fight him, then you will. There will be a glow that comes off.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's the idea of the patriarchal dividend. So in any given home or in any given conversation, the men in the room, the people who have relatively more masculinity, have more authority, speak more often, get listened to more frequently. And I like that term. This is R.W. Connell's term, who's a masculinity scholar, of patriarchal dividend. So both things are true at the same time. Hegemonic masculinity in some ways really screws men. On the other sense, you do get this sort of relative patriarchal dividend for just being a guy.
Mm-hmm. So, I assume being a Roman citizen gives you
Much more.
So
and of course, who got to be a Roman citizen changed a lot between like the year 0 and the year 300 and 400. So, but yes, it did. Citizenship mattered. That's not really relevant to most of the Jesus time period because none of those people would fit into that category. But in terms of Roman context, absolutely.
For Paul.
Yeah, that's an interesting claim that's made in Acts. I would be very, there's no way to prove a negative or a positive when it comes to that. I would be very curious to go back and ask him, how did you get that exactly, that citizenship? Yeah.
On the chart, under government class, it says Sabbatian priests. I can't quite read it.
Yeah, I apologize for the resolution on there. The point wasn't to be able to talk about the whole chart, but which one are you looking at? Under government class, retainers and priests, and then peasants, and on the left, merchants.
I thought it said retainers. I'm just curious what that's most preferred to.
Retainer class is the one who, they're the vice president for, you know, in business or in academics. I'm the vice president to for. I'm the vice president of this, for this responsibility. That's what retainers are. Okay. So in all of this mess, if you're going to do a project, you need to come up with a couple of things you can actually talk about concretely that you can compare. So from all of this, I sort of distilled these three categories that I thought worked really well for the Bible, for the New Testament. So these are three categories of masculinity that I'm going to focus on. And on Wednesday, when we come back together, we're going to apply these categories to John the Baptist and to Herod Antipas. So you might be able to anticipate that. That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, when we get together, we'll do this, the same thing with Peter. So we'll think about these categories. So wealth, dominating control over self and others, and divine service. So wealth being a way of display and also a means of power. On the right is the lifestyles of the rich and famous in Ephesus. These are apartments that have been excavated that scholars are going crazy with. I'm standing above in one of the upper apartments and I'm looking down. So that's a mosaic carpet that was in somebody's hallway in Ephesus. That's the way they decorated their places. So there's frescoes still intact. There are mosaics still intact. There's marble still intact, but you can see how people lived. So wealth was obviously a way to display power. It was a way to have slaves. It was a way to not be able to die because your slaves bear the death in their own bodies, so you live longer. So it's an expression of power and life that way. Then above, this is a coin. On the left, way over here on the left on the top, you can see it says Vespasian. We've talked about him a couple of times. So this is a Flavian coin. It comes from the time period after the fall of Jerusalem. And how do I know that? Because this is the front of it. I can teach you a word. Numismatics. My kids know this word. It means the study of coins. So we're numismatists for a moment. This is the front side of the coin. It's Vespasian's head. This is the back side of the coin. And it says, on the top right, it says capta. You see? And this is a Judea capta coin. So the symbol is, this is a coin that commemorates the destruction of the Jews. Yeah. And you'll see that there's a very large man standing there. No one seems to know what the long object is that's coming out from his belt. It's kind of hard to tell. It might be a sword, it might not be a sword. But on the other side of the tree is, that's Judea, and it's a female. So it's pictured as a woman who's crouched over, and he's very much dominating over her. Yeah. So here you have military, and you have monetary, all hooked up together. And these are the coins you had to use if you were going to pay your Roman taxes, if you were a Jew, right? These are things that you had to participate in. So wealth becomes an issue. It's a status thing. They had this idea that, of course, the more money you had, the more virtue you had, because obviously the gods favored you if you had more money, therefore you were a better person. So there was virtue signaling that went on with money. Also the means of dominant control. And it's also this whole idea of sanctioned authority. So if you can express your masculinity through wealth, dominance, this kind of thing, then you're not only dominant, but you're virtuous in your dominance. Your dominance is seen as holy because it's connected to what the gods want from you. Okay. Second category that I picked is dominating control over self and over others. This includes physical control over your own body. So a penetrating attack was seen as emasculating, so armor is very important, right? But also sexually, that would make sense. So physical control over your own body. Then physical control over another's body, restricting their movements, control over their sexuality, the power of life and death over a slave. That was a way of asserting masculinity. And then three, the role of public speech. So if your ability to speak in public and have people listen to you, or your ability to argue someone down, enhanced your masculinity. So this is Claudius. Claudius did not look like that. Claudius did not have that physical figure. He, in fact, had disabilities that kept him from being mobile at times. But that's Claudius. His sword is missing, but it was brandished over his head. This is Britannia. So this is this question that I've asked before about how do you make your enemy look? So she looks absolutely terrifying, and she looks weak. And he has her in a very, very vulnerable position. Pretty much anything could be done to her in that moment that's to happen next. So Claudius of Britannia is not a Roman statue. It's from Turkey, Aphrodisias. So this is how people in the provinces would depict Rome, Rome's masculinity over them, control over them. It's interesting. Because there's, of course, a little bit of, you know, you want to show loyalty to Rome. So he obviously looks dominant. Isn't this great? But then there's some resistance here. It's over the top. It makes it look as though they're brutal. You know, they don't even care about anything. So there's some ambivalence and maybe some tension in that. But it definitely shows dominance and control over someone else's body. This is Nero, and this is the world that he holds. He's got the whole world in his hand. And up at the top, we have Nero becoming emperor with his mother. And there again, you can see a bound captive. Do you see him at the bottom, in the center? Mm-hmm. So that's a man. He's strong in his shoulders. He's got his back to us, but he's looking. He actually has eyes. He's able to be seen. And he doesn't have his head down like this. But someone's standing on him. So there's the depiction again of dominating control over self and over others that has some ambivalence in it. Okay, last one. Divine service. This is this thing about being attached to God or to the gods. So to express your masculinity in this way meant to say that you were in alignment with God's purposes, that God approved of what you were doing, better yet, God asked you to do what you were doing. And there's also then this automatic association that if God is man is God. So there's a glow that comes off of this kind of man that's divine. It's a means of control, it's a justification of behavior, and an establishment of virtue. On the top is Augustus. And he is, behind him are the winds, and then he's standing on the land. So this is, he's Lord of land and sea. Who else is Lord of land and sea? Yeah, Jesus. Jesus is the one who stills the storm. So you start to see some of these things, these stories of Jesus, and think, oh, he's, I get it, he's resisting. Yeah. This is also in Turkey. And if you can read Greek that has no punctuation and all capital letters, yeah, right. So what you have here is the word Kyrion, Lord, Ton, Gay, of the land, Kai, Thalasse, and sea. So this is referring to a different emperor, Nero, right here. So the empire was shown to be in alignment with creation, which means they're dominant over creation, like they've been given this authority to be in charge. So there's this really funny story, it's kind of an interesting story, where Peter, there's the coin in the fish's mouth, Peter goes to Jesus and says, are we supposed to pay this tax? Because the tax collectors asks him, do you pay this tax? Do you followers of Jesus pay this tax? And he's like, I don't know, I'll get back to you. And he goes to Jesus and says, do we pay this tax or not? And he says, go down to the water and catch the fish and open the fish's mouth. And inside the fish's mouth is a coin. Use that to pay the tax. And it's this, again, this kind of story of resistance of who is in fact charge of the fish. Who puts the coin in the fish's mouth to begin with? Yeah, God. So this, you can see there's emerging some competing narratives about divine service. About who's more affiliated with the gods? Who's the one who has the authority? So a lot of the claims that Jesus makes in this context are along these kinds of lines, to be Lord of land and sea, to be the one who's in charge of creation, who's attached to the one who made everything, if that makes sense. All right, so those are my three categories. Coming out of all of this stuff about masculinity, I've given a lot to you. You've done quite well. I apologize if you feel completely overwhelmed. You can go on a hike and then lose most of it this afternoon. But I hope that some wheels are starting to turn, as we might think about some men in the Gospels. Of course, immediately start to think about Jesus. And Colleen Conway is a scholar who's really broken a lot of ground there. She has a book called Behold the Man, in which she talks about the masculinity of Jesus in all the Gospels, and then the masculinity of Jesus in Paul. But then there's, you know, masculinity in the Bible is still a new area. So what else? Are there other men? What are their characteristics like? And so we will start to apply some of these things to John the Baptist and to Peter. As we finish up today, I'm interested to think and to hear from you. Is there anything sparking that, as you think about John the Baptist, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, is there anything that makes you think about these masculinity issues as you think about John? It doesn't have to be about John. It could be about somebody else.
I just immediately thought of what he wore. There's lots of conversation about what he wore, mm-hmm. and wondering how that set him apart, or if it was some kind of act of defiance of what was traditional male.
Exactly. That's a mystery, right? Because he wears these. The Bible actually is one of the few descriptions of what somebody's wearing, as what John the Baptist is wearing, and it doesn't seem to be conventional. And it certainly is not a mark of wealth, right? A cloak of camel's hair. And the leather girdle around his waist. So is that some sort of separation from the narrative, from that identity? I find John the Baptist to be a very masculine kind of figure. Mm-hmm. But you put him up against this stuff and it makes no sense. So how is he a man if this is what masculinity is? These are the kind of questions that keep you up at night. Only if you're me. Only if you're me. Yeah, so what is that? Is that a way of separating himself from that? Or is it a way of arguing against it? And saying, I'm going to define this differently. Is he an example of an ordinary man who has an alternative understanding of masculinity that other people would have had, but we don't have access to that?
Is that a tough guy
mm-hmm.
image?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely think that's part of it.
As you introduced all of this with talking about Roman Empire's context, and it's in the front, and it kind of goes over the top of everything, it makes me then think about stories about Moses and the parting of the sea, and, mm-hmm. and within that context now, is this just as much about, you know, God providing, you know, this escape, but also this then show of masculinity, I am now the master of this right. water within the Roman context, mm-hmm. with Jesus walking on water, I am the master of this water, I'm the calm of the seas,
yes.
within a Roman context. It's just mm-hmm. it's a way that I hadn't thought about it before, but mm-hmm. but it certainly is this miracle but also it's a way to show the Romans, you may have these notions of masculinity, but it's almost like thumbing your nose, right? We also are hypermasculine as well.
Mm-hmm. And this all, you know, this translatable to Egypt, right? We're talking thousands of years of separation. Mm-hmm. But if you think about the plagues themselves, control over nature, right? Mm-hmm. I can turn this wine and, or this water into blood. I was thinking water into wine. Water into blood. I can make frogs come. I can make, and the power over of life and death. And so, and I think maybe a difference, though, is that, and we can talk about all of this, who comes off as the real man in that kind of Moses story? Is it Moses or is it God? Mm-hmm. This is always the thing when you talk about masculinity, because everything's like the dot is God. The dot is not Jesus, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like, because God is the one who maintains this sort of impenetrability, mm-hmm. where Jesus is penetrated. Jesus is stabbed in the side. So this is stuff we argue about and wonder about. Who's the real man? How is it shown? But the masculinity piece is absolutely there. So here and then back up.
So I was thinking about the gospel reading from last night about Mary and how she aligned herself.
Yes.
In this, she was obviously a woman who had some means. Mm-hmm. So how would the Roman world then have dealt with these masculinity transgressors?
Isn't that interesting? I was like, that's my next project. As Melinda was reading last night, I was thinking about that, because she does that. The appeal is made to her divine service, right? If the Savior chose her, who are we to argue? So her authority comes from him. And so it is a masculine authority that's given to her. There's public speech involved, right? She's speaking and being listened to by some, not by all. But her message, even though it's lost, was received in the time period. So women who behave in masculine ways, there are plenty of examples of women of means in the Roman Empire, Pontius Magnus, one that I can think of right now, who did this, who had access to means through an accident in the way that their family system was arranged, and so they did very masculine things. And they would have had rank, masculine rank, over men of a lower social class. Absolutely. And so you see this play out in, like, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. So that because it's not completely tied to body parts, so that gender identity, sexuality can be expressed in all these different ways, that there's ways for women to act in masculine ways. In my dissertation defense, I had to say, that's beyond the scope of my project. But I'm so interested in this, because I think this relates very much to our contemporary kind of context. And part of the critique of the Gnostic Gospels is the only way that Mary becomes legitimate is that she essentially becomes a man. She is not lifted up for womanhood, or in sort of like, in spite of being a woman, Jesus liked her and sort of made her into a man. And so the conversations that we have about sort of gender transgression, or the way that we express our behaviors in the world, is that it's masculinity is still all cool, so it's really okay if women act like men. Like, we'll be all right if they sort of act like men, but we really don't like it in the reverse, because we still have this thing about masculinity and femininity. Mm-hmm. So, who's right here?
I was going to say, you know, from the context of the Roman context, and then the common people, and how they viewed the fact that there was this power among common men, mm-hmm. and it didn't lie with one. Right. Yes, Jesus was maybe the leader of that, but Moses had power, John the Baptist had power.
Peter
had power. I mean, mm-hmm. there was, and even Mary had a little bit of power. Mm-hmm. That the view of that is interesting to me. Mm-hmm. How the Romans saw, wait a minute, like, what's happening? What's being occurred? And then the common people looking at that and saying, wow, that who's in charge?
Yes. So the hegemonic idea, hegemony itself, is very much a part of every layer of society. Right. And so then you have your guy die.
Right.
Yeah? Right. And not in an honorable way. Right. He did not fall on his own sword to, you know, before someone could kill him. He was crucified. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing gets turned upside down mm-hmm. at that point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's awesome. I was thinking about we know a little bit about what crucifixion says about masculinity, but mm-hmm. I was thinking about John's death. What yeah. does beheading say in terms of...
Exactly what you think. If a woman cuts off your head,
okay.
your head, that's a problem. yeah. yeah. So that's very much a part of that. It's not a righteous death, and it's not a noble death. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think it's here, and then I'll come back, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking a little bit, as you go into John the Baptist, is he's the one who announces Jesus, mm-hmm. and or who are the ones who announce the coming of Caesar, back in the day. I don't know if there's any, if that's getting too far afield or if that is something to go with that.
That's an interesting thought. I haven't given much thought to that. I've thought a lot about the fact that there's, you know, John shows up and he has authority, and then at some point Jesus has to best him. Yeah? So that's the part of that, that relationship that I thought of. But what you're suggesting is really interesting. I want to give that a little more thought too.
We're just thinking Jewish masculinity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Gospels have lots of different audiences. And I just wonder, yes, Rome had authority over this area, but also Jesus was operating in a Jewish context as well. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how the two of them sort of brushed up against each other, because they probably had different...
Some differences, but in a lot of ways, ancient masculinity is ancient masculinity.
Is it okay?
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that the divine service piece plays out differently. Like, obedience is an important value. Like, Joseph becomes a very important man, never says a thing, right? Basically, is on the run the whole time. But he protects his family, and he keeps them intact. They're not penetrated in any way. They're not attacked by anybody. And Joseph is obedient to God. And so then his stature rises. So I do think that the divine service piece plays out a little differently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's more along the prophetic lines or on the obedience lines. Yeah.
Well, I just wondered, in your research, as all of this is unfolding, and most of the early church then followed the Roman Empire model of creating a pope and male hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there was that thread that went off into Ireland, so that Celtic piece that had goddess worship, how does that compare?
Oh, it's so complicated. But I think that, you know, for me, the dominant thing to come out of this is that both things are true within the tradition of Christianity. And that's what makes it so hard and why there's so much tension with being a person of the Christian tradition. Because there's this reassertion of masculinity that takes place, especially by the time of Constantine. Like, we like this religion. We'll just build a bunch of big buildings and spend a lot of money, and then we'll be Christians. Wait, what? That's the opposite of the way this whole thing began. So both things are from the beginning a part of this. And the other thing is, it's like anything else. Culture isn't the thing you do. It's the water you swim in. So Christianity was born in empire. So this term that we use all the time, kingdom of God or kingdom of heaven, it's basileia. Anybody who would be associated with Rome would translate that, not kingdom, empire. Mm-hmm. So what is the empire of God? Mm-hmm. That changes it for me when I think about that word. Mm-hmm. Do I still want that? Mm-hmm. Because it's an empire. We like kingdom because we come out of the, you know, the British tradition, and it comes kind of through that way. But when I think about an empire of God, that seems somehow more oppressive. I don't know, that word is different for me. So there is this resistance strand, and in Ephesus, outside of Ephesus, up in the hills. Anybody been to Ephesus? To that incredible site? I don't know if you've seen, but up in the caves, up on the hills behind Ephesus, there's a cave that has Thecla and Theoclea inside, and that's one of these other gospels, like the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and the Gospel of Paul. Thecla wants to be a disciple. Paul won't take her on. She follows him, cuts her own hair, and baptizes herself because Paul won't do it. He won't name her an apostle. So she just does it herself. And there is a picture of her inside this cave up on the side of Ephesus and of her mother, Theoclea. And she stands right next to Paul, and she's standing there like this. And Paul is standing next to her, and he's standing here like this. So this is like the preaching pose, and her eyes are gouged out. And that, to me, that's like the symbol of what you're talking about. There's always this symbol of resistance or of a different way of doing things, and then there's the empire always strikes back. There's always this move to squelch or silence or change. So I think of Theoclea up there in that cabin in the woods, up in the hills, the cave where Christians would go to worship. Because she was very clearly, she's exactly the same size as Paul, and she's on the same level as Paul. Mm-hmm. She's not shorter, she's exactly the same height. So that's very much part of it, and yet people come along later and say no. But was there anybody else on the side that I missed? Then I think you're next.
Interesting that the Roman Catholic Church has raised up Mary to be so significant within the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes, And I think I wasn't able to go because I was kid wrangling last night, but Eric came to Austin's talk and you talked a lot about complementarianism as a way of thinking about gender. And I see that a lot in the way that the Roman Catholic Church talks about Mary and venerates Mary. I don't know that this is in any way historical, but she's venerated for being quiet, for being obedient, for being pure, for having, they go so far as to say no sin attached to her, right? So she's elevated, but like the opposite of Mary Magdalene. You know, she's elevated for being submissive. And that's a weird thing to say, but that becomes sort of the model of femininity. So you can have Jesus and you can have Mary, but it's not the same. It's not the same elevation. Okay, I'm going to ask Ari first.
Yeah, I was just going to say as an addendum to that, in later medieval periods, when you get into the period where there are lots of cults of sainthood around female figures in medieval Europe, a lot of that actually has to do with women who specifically had obedient relationships to their confessors, mm-hmm. and that was one of the qualifiers for what does a holy woman look like, mm-hmm. Is the, does she listen to her confessor and allow him to guide her?
Yeah.
So it's still that piece of, like, what does a virtuous woman look like? Mm-hmm. And there's still the masculinity element in that. And that's something that, like, endures into...
Absolutely. Yeah. And gains steam, yeah.
And at what level, when we think about Roman context, when you think about, they're talking about the association with the divine, mm-hmm. and is there some kind of then association with the divine for Mary with the divine conception of Christ, and did that then become a parallel or a connection for her?
Yeah, all of this evolves over time. So in this era, not very much about Mary the mother of Jesus, but right. as over time, yes, there is this sense of there's a connection to the divine, and you can't put that away. So maybe we have to couch it in these terms that makes it less threatening.
Right.
I mean, she has this amazing power to bear God, but at the same time, she needs to be submissive.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
I know that it's noon, and so I'm conscious of that. So if anybody needs to go, you're good. Anybody else? Thoughts? I hope this has sparked some ideas and some thinking. I've overwhelmed you with a whole lot of stuff. You can take maybe one or two things away from this today. Like, gender is something you have to perform. Masculinity is not automatic. You have to argue for it. And that there are different ways that you can do that. And so these three ways we talked about today, we'll apply them to these other figures, which is John the Baptist tomorrow, and Herod Antipas, and then we'll do Peter on Thursday. So thank you very much for your time.